Hi, I'm Connor Friedersdorf. I am currently blogging at The Atlantic, writing an ideas blog. I also blog at The American Scene, and I am starting a new project at True Slant called Metablog, where I'm going to pick a blog each week and write intensively about it.
I'm Connor Clark. I'm a correspondent for The Atlantic, where I write a blog mostly about policy and economics. I guess the great gimmick here is that we are, as far as I know, the only two journalists in D.C. named Connor, and I guess the feeling was that there can be only one. I don't know if you would agree with that, but I certainly...
Well, I actually think after this dialogue, a lot of Connors are going to see that it's possible to have our name and be journalists in D.C., and so there could be actually a rush.
I do think I have one great advantage over you, which is that I have a last name that is relatively easy to spell.
Yes, I've got a Google trail that I cannot hide from, no matter what.
Whereas there are all sorts of Irish soccer players named Connor Clark. There is a female photographer in New Zealand named Connor. I mean, it's sort of wonderful.
There's a town in Germany named Friedersdorf that pops up on my Google alerts a lot, but I can't read any of it because it's in German.
I'm sorry. Well, where should we start? I guess...
you have another blog that you haven't mentioned about...
That's true, yes. I'm going to flash the book in front of the camera. So Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias and my roommate Chris Beam from Slate and a bunch of others, Julian Sanchez, started a group blog about Infinite Jest, the David Foster Wallace novel. And basically this is just piggybacking on the Infinite Summer book project, where basically anyone in the country can pick up the book and kind of follow along that blog, infinitesummer.org, and I guess they can follow along with our blog as well. We will be doing 70 pages a week, although I totally failed to read 70 pages last week, and when any of us have random thoughts about the book or David Foster Wallace, we will be putting them up on the blog, which I will now shamelessly plug. It is a supposedly fun blog, .wordpress.com. The title, I guess David Foster Wallace fans will know, comes from a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, which, Connor, tell me if I'm wrong, is an essay about taking a cruise, right?
Yes, it's a wonderful essay about going on a cruise ship and how awful it is, even though the water is perfectly blue and the food is perfectly wonderful. It's sort of existentially awful, David Foster Wallace argues. And I'm really a fan of David Foster Wallace's nonfiction writing. I have read just about all of it that I can find. I don't know that I've gotten to it all yet. But he's written wonderful things about tennis. I played junior tennis in Southern California and have really enjoyed his stuff. He wrote a great piece on Roger Federer for the New York Times Sports Magazine. He wrote a great piece for Harper's a while back on the Garner's Dictionary of, I guess it's not a dictionary, it's a usage guide, the Garner's Usage Guide and how it updates Fowler's, and it's just this wonderfully entertaining essay about language, and the only thing I've ever read or probably ever will read about a usage guide. Unlike some who like his nonfiction, I like his fiction too. I really enjoyed Infinite Jest when I read it. I think partly because I am a former tennis player, and he really gets the world of junior tennis. Of course, he has a fantastical way of writing, and so it's not as though it's a realist account. But he definitely captures the essence of it, I think. So how are you doing so far?
I guess I would say I'm sort of yet to fall in love with it, and I suppose one of the problems is, this is a relatively unsophisticated way of treating fiction, but I don't read a huge amount of fiction. I read some, a fair amount, and most of that fiction, I would say I read for fun, and part of the problem it seems to me that I'm having with the David Foster Wallace novel is that it is intentionally, as far as I understand, not fun. That part of the experience he is trying to create with the novel is, one of disorienting the reader. I guess the very first way this came up was, the book is full of endnotes, and this came up on the blog as well. I think Matt Matt Iglesias made the original point that you know, endnotes are utterly crazy. I don't know why anyone would put endnotes in a book, why anyone would defend endnotes. You know, footnotes, in my opinion, are just so much easier to follow when you're reading something. They break up the flow of the text a lot less. But as far as I understand it, you know, David Foster Wallace wanted endnotes in this book to make the experience more disjointed for the reader. He wanted people to have to stop and get confused and flip to the back and search. I don't really know how I feel about that. I guess, you know, on one hand I can say, okay, you are making a point about how contemporary Americans communicate and, you know, the ways in which our lives are newly disjointed and newly disorienting. You know, on the other hand, my general feeling is, you know, for kind of points about society, fiction isn't the first place I'd look. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm yet to come to appreciate a kind of novel that is intentionally screwing around with me and disorienting me and you know, basically making itself difficult to get through the entire 1,070 pages.
Yeah, as a general proposition, I agree with that. I mean, I, for example, am not a fan of Ulysses or mm-hmm. Finnegan's Wake for precisely this reason. You know, if you dig into it and study it, you can see ways in which James Joyce is a genius in many ways, but is being a genius the point of writing a book? I don't think so. I'm generally a fan of, you know, I'm a great Ernest Hemingway fan. That's The Sun Also Rises is my mm-hmm. kind of novel. At the same time, I don't know. I liked Infinite Jest because I didn't think of it as an intentionally difficult book. And I may be wrong about this. I haven't read interviews with David Foster Wallace about writing it or anything like that. I guess the novel that I would compare it to is mm-hmm. Don Quixote. I think Cervantes and David Foster Wallace both have a playfulness and a willingness to sort of flout narrative conventions, and they're both books that kind of go all over the place here and there and have just sort of wild departures from the plot and go off in all sorts of directions, but I think often to good effect. And it's such a big book, I hated flipping to the back for the endnotes too, but some of the endnotes are amazing. I mean, there's this one 4 or 5 page endnote about the rise and fall of the video mm-hmm. phone, and it traces the technology and talks about the idea of seeing someone as you're talking to them on the phone and how people begin to realize that when you're talking to someone on the phone, half the time they aren't actually paying attention mm-hmm. to what you're saying. There's actually overlaps with blogging. We should find out for that.
And I guess, you know, generally it seems like there are plenty of passages that I love, and so far it seems like there are plenty of sections in the book that taken as sort of discrete, insular, short stories, I very, very, very much enjoy. I suppose that, you know, maybe the distinction here, I wonder if this is one you'd agree with, is between you know, appreciating the novelty of something and appreciating all the ways in which it is new and experimental, and actually enjoying something and having the experience of sitting down with this book be an experience that, you know, creates various chemical explosions in my head that are very pleasurable. And, you know, I definitely have the former part of that. There's a lot that I find very interesting and intriguing and appealing about it, but I'm not sure I've discovered the latter, at least taken as a whole.
I'll be curious to see if by the end of the book you continue to feel this way, and you may well, or if you come to enjoy it more in the same way that you enjoy Shakespeare more after you plunge back into it and read the first 10 pages and sort of get back into, you know, the older style of English, and once you sort of get into the...
Yeah, well, I hope so too. I suppose there's always a chance that I will just give up. But as of now, I've committed myself to reading it, and, you know, probably when the blogging heads is done, I will close my computer and read another 5 or 10 pages or something like that.
Well, in that case, in the interest of reading David Foster Wallace, we should move on. And let's talk about Adultery and Politicians. This has been in the news lately, Mark Sanford being the most recent example, I think, although you never know what's at the top of the Drudge Report right now.
Right. So this is, you know, it seems to me that the big appealing story in American politics right now, besides all the Franken stuff that's going on in Minnesota, is, you know, just a kind of series of wonderfully devastating personal stories. One is, as you say, Mark Sanford. His staff thinks he's hiking the Appalachian Trail. He is, in fact, flying to Buenos Aires to see an Argentinian woman with whom he is having an affair. Another is John Edwards. In yesterday's newspaper, I'm sure everyone read this just kind of astonishing account of his former aide Andrew Young's book proposal. You know, the three, I think, most salacious details, again, which everyone probably knows, are, you know, number one, he seems to have made a sex tape with Riel Hunter. Number two, according to Young, he was planning on marrying Hunter after Elizabeth Edwards died and had gone so far as to pick wedding music with the woman he was having an affair with. And then, you know, last and not least, Andrew Young alleges, although I think, you know, everyone probably assumed this was the case months ago, that that John Edwards is in fact the father of Riel Hunter's child, who was living with Andrew Young for a while, and originally Andrew Young had claimed was his own. So that's Sanford, that's Edwards. You know, there's also this big Sarah Palin story that was in Vanity Fair. You know, I'm very glad to see that Andrew Sullivan is now back on the Trig Palin beat, writing a lot of posts about Palin's pregnancy, why the media isn't covering it, so on and so forth. And you know, it seems to me the million-dollar question here, you know, basically whenever a politician, a public figure's dirty laundry gets aired, is why on earth should we care? You know, why is this a story that is at all important? Why should we care whether or not John Edwards is the father of a child with a woman he had an affair with? He's not running for office anymore. All interesting questions. I have a take on them. I don't know if you want to say anything first, or whether I should just launch into my second monologue on why we should care about politicians' personal lives.
Well, sure. I mean, I would say my take is that we shouldn't care. My
that we should not care, you said.
Personally, as a news consumer, I don't care. I don't particularly want to read about this stuff. And, you know, I understand the impulse to care. I understand that people see, especially the President of the United States, as a moral leader. And I guess as years have gone by, I've just grown increasingly suspicious of that. I mean, you know, I've worked in a bunch of different corporations and a bunch of different publications. I've had tons of bosses over my life. The ones that are of the most upright moral character and the ones that are the most effective don't seem to overlap in any kind of, you know, regular way. I would also say that I'm just suspicious of the notion that we should look to our president as a moral leader. It's kind of an impulse that I've had, especially since reading Gene Healy's The Cult of the Presidency, that what we should do is find people to look to for moral leadership who actually have the qualities that we want in a moral leader, not who are particularly good at, you know, running the bureaucracy or being the commander-in-chief of the army. And I guess I would lastly say that, you know, there's a lot of talk about how this is ruining Mark Sanford's career, and I will acknowledge that running off to Argentina has implications apart from the affair about whether you can be an effective leader, whether you're sort of responsible.
And I should certainly, you know, just jump in and say as well, it seems to me that a very separate question in all of this, besides the affairs and so on, is how public funds are being used. If you know, if it is true that Mark Sanford used money from his state to conduct this affair with the Argentinian woman, or if it is true that John Edwards inappropriately used campaign funds to conduct his affair with Riel Hunter, it's a very different issue from the moral question of you know should we care about leaders' sex lives? Would you agree with that characterization?
Yes, I do agree that they're very different questions. To sum up before you make your point, I mean, when I look at, say, Mark Sanford versus Bill Clinton, it seems to me that, you know, if you're using the metric of moral standards, I think that Bill Clinton behaved much worse by virtue of, you know, having a relationship with an intern who he had direct power right. over as her boss. I think it was just, you know, an extraordinarily creepy situation.
Exploitation is the concern on people's minds, you know.
Yeah, and I think, and, you know, he had obviously a long past of this sort of thing. Compared to Mark Sanford, who, you know, although it's inexcusable to do what he did, I think he does seem to have genuine affection for a woman who is who he doesn't have power over, who there isn't any exploitation going on. And yet, you know, Mark Sanford's political career is probably over because of this, and Bill Clinton went to win re-election. And,
right.
you know, aside from the fact that it was an issue, did it make him a worse president? I mean, because it was a distraction, because we do care about these things, uh-huh. yes, it did. But if we didn't care about these things, would it have? I don't think so. So, but go ahead. You may
so
have
I guess, you know, I sympathize with a lot of what you're saying. You know, I do want to push back in one, you know, maybe possibly fundamental respect, and that is, you know, it seems to me that a lot of how we treat the standards by which we treat politicians can to some extent be influenced by the politicians themselves. And it does seem to me that it is more reasonable to be interested in Mark Sanford's personal life or in Sarah Palin's personal life or in Bill Clinton's personal life or in John Edwards' personal life when they are running on the basis of those things as qualifications for a job. And you might say they shouldn't run on the basis of those things as qualifications for a job, but nonetheless it is the case that they do. And I think if Sarah Palin is saying part of what qualifies me for office is coming from a real family with real problems, you know, Trig Palin, you know, having a disabled child, having a daughter who was pregnant as a teenager, you know, if Mark Sanford is saying part of what qualifies me for office is that I'm a good, upstanding family man who understands family values, it seems to me that they're setting up a standard, a public standard, by which they can be judged. You know, if John Edwards is saying as well, as John Edwards did say, if you vote for me, you will get two for the price of one because I have this fantastic wife and, you know, she's incredibly important to me and influential on my ideas. You know, it seems to me that they're setting up a standard, and you can't have it both ways. I don't think they can say, please, 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 public, you know, consider my personal family attributes when you decide whether or not to vote for me, and also say on the other side of the coin, please give me privacy. This has absolutely no impact on the job I do governing. What do you think of that distinction?
I think that's a fair point. There's this maddening circularity here. Julian Sanchez wrote a post that has the same sort of circularity where he basically said the fact that Mark Sanford cheated on his wife made it such that someone could be in a position to blackmail mm-hmm. Mark Sanford as governor and say, you know, I'm going to go forward with this unless you do what I say.
Right.
And so it's the situation where it only matters, you know, if that were the metric we were using, if that were the thing we were concerned about, it would only matter that he cheated on his wife because it matters that he cheated on his wife.
And well, I do think there's a circularity in what I'm saying. I don't think the circularity is quite that bad.
No, I don't think it is either. But I do think that it's not a perfect analogy, but I do think that there is this same, how do you get out of this, you know?
Well, I think the answer there is
not to matter, but politicians
shouldn't run on the basis of their family circumstances if they're going to turn around and say the media owes us privacy and the media can't ask questions about what my family is doing and the media can't cover my daughter and the media can't cover my affair.
Sure. You know, interestingly, probably if John Edwards would have been elected president, you would have gotten two for one, despite the fact that he was cheating and. you kind of got 2-for-1 when Bill Clinton was elected, despite his.
So that's perfectly fine. I mean, I'm willing to abandon the 2-for-1 part. I'm not willing to abandon. I mean, you wouldn't.
Yeah, no. I think your point stands. I think your larger point stands, and I concede it.
So would you? Talking solutions, I suppose. Would you like to live in a world in which Sarah Palin did not say one of my qualifications for office is the fact that I understand traditional family values, and I come from an American family that is complicated in all the ways in which American families are typically complicated. You know, it seems to me I don't know. It's confusing because maybe that's a good argument. Maybe that's an argument we should take seriously, or maybe, I mean, I assume it's an argument that a lot of Americans take pretty seriously. On the other hand, it does seem to me like one thing that follows from accepting that argument is you necessarily delimit the zone of reasonable privacy you can demand from journalists and from voters. I don't know.
I'll concede that there are circumstances when someone's personal life maybe does inform the kind of leader that they would be. But if I were to set a general rule, I would prefer to just avoid it all. I think overall we would be better off if we ignored all of that kind of stuff. I think Sarah Palin's a pretty decent example of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's say that everything she says about her personal life is absolutely accurate. And I don't think that means that she's qualified to be president or that she was qualified to be vice president. In fact, I think it's very clear that she wasn't. Another way, actually, to sort of go about this would be for politicians to only run on family values when, you know, they're not cheating on their
okay,
wives.
Well, there's, I mean,
but
there,
I suppose
yeah,
that's
I mean, there are deep
to
philosophical
ask.
Questions there, I suppose, as well. I definitely agree with that. I would prefer to abandon the whole shebang, and I would certainly prefer to live in a world in which Bill Clinton and John Edwards and Mark Sanford and Sarah Palin all did not say something that qualifies me for office is my sterling family life.
Right, and I would argue that America was better served by this in the past, was better served in an era when we had presidents whose personal lives weren't the subject of all this kind of gossip
right,
and concern.
Okay.
But I also think that it isn't a change in mores, really, as so much as a change of technology that's driven all of this, and I fear that it's only going to get worse. I fear that, 20 years from now, someone's going to run for president and people are going to be sifting through their Twitter feeds and their Facebook pictures, and it's just going to be...
Well, that's a very interesting and, it seems to me, separate question. I mean, definitely it is the case that... I presume if you or I were, not this is not going to happen. But I mean, if we were ever in a position where the Senate had to approve us for something, it just wouldn't work. Like I've written a huge number of really stupid blog posts that I'm sure 20 years from now or something, everyone will find embarrassing or offensive. I don't know. I mean, maybe have you written stupid blog posts that 20 years from now you would look back and say, yeah, that's pretty embarrassing and offensive.
Oh, I'm sure that I have. I mean, I haven't gone back and looked at the print archives of my college newspaper, but I wrote in it. I'm sure that I wrote yeah. opinion columns that I now disagree with. And I think actually what's going to happen is that we're going to go through some period of time when, politicians who grew up in the Facebook era are going to be running for office and people are going to be sifting through it, and there's going to be all of these kerfuffles, and then maybe people are ultimately going to stop caring, sort of in the same way that they stopped caring about...
Smoking marijuana.
About whether or not you smoke marijuana. Yeah, I think that may be what happens when it turns out that everyone has these... things in their digital history. Or maybe we'll just end up, electing people named John Smith because they have plausible deniability. And they can say, oh, that wasn't me, John Smith. That was another John Smith.
What can I say? I mean, I guess, forget Facebook pictures and blog posts and things like that. I mean, just, think about emails. Like, the thousands upon thousands of incredibly dumb, offensive emails I've written over the course of my life that are not going to disappear, that are all sitting on some... giant server in Western Washington State waiting. I mean,
oh, it's absolutely true that Google is going to be able to blackmail every future American president. There's no
right, problem. And I certainly hope it is true that there is a shift in values. I think you can, on the one hand, I think you can say maybe we're starting to see the beginnings of that with things like the drug usage, which would have been disqualifying 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I think. And now, you know, I mean, Obama has a book in which he says he did cocaine. George Bush, I don't think this is a mischaracterization to say that he basically acknowledged, you know, as kind of a non-denial that he had done cocaine as well. Yeah, I mean, one can hope.
Yeah, and one can also hope that that fear of this kind of digital trail doesn't prevent really good people from mm-hmm. from going into politics, but I fear that it will.
Or from writing offensive emails, is the other side.
Well, let's move on sure. to the next topic, which is you and I got into an exchange about a summer school, about whether or not school should be extended to go all year round. And why don't you kick it off by just sort of restating the argument that your argument that got us talking.
Sure. Yeah, I think the argument against summer vacation is reasonably simple. I guess three things I would say. One is there's a huge amount of educational loss that occurs over the summer. So the standard summer vacation in the United States is 3 months. There are 180 days of school, but there's one big, as every school child knows, a big 3 month vacation over the summer, and a tremendous amount of learning is lost in that time. If you look at standardized test scores in spring, on the whole, they are substantially higher than standardized test scores in the fall. You know, it seems to me that is kind of inefficient. So one argument is basically from educational achievement. The second argument, it seems to me, is basically an argument from inequality. And if you look at, you know, my understanding of the evidence here is that if you were to look at the summer learning loss, the amount of education that is lost between the spring and fall testing periods, it is far, far, far worse for children from low-income families. That basically, if you look at the amount of learning that occurs in public schools between low-income and high-income children, it's actually pretty close during the winter months, during, you know, basically the months that are thick with classes and education and so on and so forth. But a lot more gets lost over the summer, and I think basically what education researchers surmise happens is children from middle-income and upper-middle-income families can give their kids all sorts of edifying summer experiences, you know, Shakespeare camp, or that's not a real thing, I hope. But basically,
sure
it probably
it is.
Okay, maybe it is a real thing. But basically things like that, that low-income students cannot get. And it seems to me that, you know, this should be reasonably uncontroversial. One of the things that I think there is wide agreement on across the political spectrum is that expanding equality of opportunity is a good thing. And it seems to me like there is some real low-hanging fruit for expanding equality of opportunity in this case. The last thing that I would say about the summer vacation is that even if you think there are countervailing considerations, even if you think there's some value to kind of spending your childhood blissfully in the kind of summer reverie, you know, hanging out by the pond or something like that. I mean, whatever your picture of childhood bliss is, even if you think that's true, there's little reason to believe that the current vacation setup is optimal, because as far as I understand it, the current vacation setup is basically a historical accident. I'll very quickly retell the story of how we ended up with the vacation. Basically, when graded schooling was invented in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, schools, they had consistent standards for judging students and needed to basically decide arbitrarily on a consistent start time. And the reason most schools in the country picked September is basically that the summer months in the 19th and early 20th centuries were the months in which families had the easiest time moving. And the early 20th century, there's a lot of interurban migration that started. And I guess the feeling was, for practical reasons, families needed to have a long period of time in the summer to move from city to city to readjust to new school districts. And that starting the school year in September with a relatively long summer break preceding it was the best way to go about handling that situation. And I think that's actually a perfectly fine reason for why summer vacation emerged, but I just think that argument is much, much less powerful today. You know, it does not take 3 months to move from one end of the country to another. It is much easier to move in this day and age, and it is relatively easier for families to adjust to new locations. So I don't know what the optimal vacation would be, but it seems to me highly unlikely that the optimal vacation would be 3 months. In any event, you wrote some articles disagreeing with this, so why is that? How could you disagree with the position that so seems so obvious and, you know, helping poor kids and so on? But
well, I think first I grew up in Southern California, and my summers were sort of idyllic Beach Boy like summers spent boogie boarding and later surfing, and you know, I went to pretty competitive schools, and they were pretty grueling during the academic year, and the summer was definitely a time to unwind for my friends and I. It was a time to play sports. It was a time to spend more time with my family than I got to during the academic year. And just from, I think my own nostalgia for childhood summers mm-hmm. makes me acutely aware of how precious a thing they were. I think that I will always look back on that time in my life as a wonderful one, look back on summer vacations as a wonderful institution. And I think that a lot of people share that mm-hmm. and that has a value. I would argue a value mm-hmm. much higher than if I were able to retroactively score higher on standardized tests and have whatever additional knowledge that would imply.
So is your, are you saying...
You mentioned...
Go on.
Well... And so you mentioned that there's educational loss over the summer, and I think that you're defining educational loss too narrowly. You're defining it based on standardized tests, and I would say that education isn't just academic mm-hmm. subjects. Education is I certainly learn things during the summer. I learn things from, you know, playing outside in my driveway when I was 7 years old, playing pickup basketball and having tournaments around my street and playing kick mm-hmm. the can and all these kinds of things. I learned socialization. I learned competitiveness. I learned mm-hmm. independence and, you know, riding my bike around my neighborhood, going to the beach, you know, teaching myself how to surf, exploring different things. I think these all have educational value.
And would you want to make policy on the basis of your personal experience? If you were the kind of world dictator or something?
I mean, certainly if I thought that it only applied to me, I would not want to make a policy on the basis of my mm-hmm. personal experience. But, I guess my larger argument against getting rid of summer vacation is just that I would agree that if what we wanted to do was maximize test scores, then mm-hmm. I'm sure it would make more sense to have more hours of school. I mean, I'm sure extending the school day would also mm-hmm. make sense, and I just don't think that that is our only goal when it comes to how we as a society raise our children. I think that school is a very structured environment that is meant to do specific things, and that play is an unstructured environment that does mm-hmm. other things, and that both of them are valuable. You mentioned that it's a historical accident that we have a three-month-long summer break, and that therefore it probably isn't optimal. And, you know, I think that there's something to that. If I were designing the world anew, I don't know exactly how long I would make mm-hmm. school breaks and exactly how long I would have kids in school. You know, maybe I would have them in less than now. I don't know. But I guess that I would say that although it was a historical accident when it came about, our culture has been built up around mm-hmm. that historical accident. And so families go on summer vacations and kids get restless when it gets to be late May. And, you know, if you were to dismantle it now, you wouldn't just lose the historical accident. You would lose all of the sort of cultural things that have built up around it and that makes sense for that reason. You know, the fact that families take their vacations in August, et cetera.
So I think, I guess, you know, it seems to me that there are a couple of questions I would have. I mean, one question about all this is, it is not necessarily the case, it seems to me, and I think this came up on the blog as well, that that changing the summer vacation requires having students spend a greater proportion of the school year in school. And it, you know, it seems to me that I mean, really the low-hanging fruit here, if there's going to be agreement on this subject, is just taking the number of vacation days that exist now and spreading it out over the course of the school year. And there, you know, it seems to me a lot of your arguments about the importance of cultivating freedom and, you know, the importance of doing things outside of a structured environment would perhaps fall away in that instance. You know, the second point that I kind of want to make is, I think, you know, it seems to me that the argument from the expansion of human freedom can cut in two directions here. I certainly, to some extent, enjoyed my summers and sympathize with you when you say that they are important for doing things in an unstructured fashion and for, you know, pursuing one's own interests and so on. But, you know, on the other hand, it seems to me that insofar as the argument for changing summer vacation is about expanding equality of opportunity is also about expanding human freedom, about giving people additional resources to pursue the things that they want to pursue. And you know, it seems to me that expansion in human freedom, although, you know, this isn't a point, you know, there's no mathematical comparison here. I don't know how you'd go about comparing the loss of human freedom in one respect to the rise of human freedom in the other. But it does seem to me like expanding educational opportunities expands freedom in a more meaningful way than, you know, letting middle-class kids enjoy their summer breaks. You know, it just seems kind of intuitively true to me that is the case.
Well, okay, I guess a couple of quick.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget the first point. So can we agree? I mean, would you be interested in spreading those vacation days out? I guess is one question.
Well, if your initial argument is that more schooling is what leads to better test scores, why would spreading the days out, but having the same amount of vacation, accomplish what you want?
I think they're just like diminishing returns for additional. I mean, you know, so you might lose X amount of learning over a week of vacation, but over 2 weeks of vacation, it's not the case that you learn. You will lose 2x vacation. You might lose 2x plus one. I mean, just the sort of the function by which learning loss occurs, I don't think is a function in which days are equivalent. I think it expands. My reading of the evidence is that it expands when vacations are longer. So the amount of learning you would lose over 3 months is substantially longer than the amount of learning you would lose over 1 week periods spread out over the course of a year that add up to 3 months. I think that's the argument.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'd have to think more about the sort of practical implications of changing that around.
I mean, there are lots of schools that do it already.
Yeah, you are right about that. There are lots of schools that have a shorter, you know, a month and a half in the summer and the rest of the stuff spread out. I mean, I certainly like that compromise better than just lengthening the school year. And, you know, I think that having that time for freedom and exploration and non-school things is definitely my primary concern. And I would argue that there are some benefits of having an extended break, but certainly, you know, I can see that there are costs too, and I don't have, you know, very strong opinions about how exactly to draw the line. I'd have to read a lot more to get to that. But as far as the equity issue, you were saying that over breaks, you know, wealthier kids basically have the ability to have edifying experiences, and therefore there's sort of greater inequality as a result of these breaks. And I would say I don't want to pursue equality of opportunity by taking away the edifying experiences of better off kids. It seems like rather than force everyone to go to school all summer when some kids are fine under the current system and some kids aren't, doesn't it make more sense
to
isolate the kids who are hurt by, you know, doesn't it make sense to isolate the kids who are falling behind? And if the most cost-effective way to bring them up to speed is to put them through school during the summer, well, then, you know, offer that choice to them. I have no objection to...
Oh, sure. I mean,
I have no objection to that.
So we could imagine a system in which the school year was expanded in such a way as, you know maybe the... There was an article in the Washington Post that's slipping my mind, the details of which are slipping my mind, but basically, that article in the Post was the original peg for my first blog post on the subject, but basically the argument of that piece in the Post was, my kids, it was written by some Post reporter whose children attended school at one of these all-year-round places, my kids have a qualitatively different kind of educational experience over the summer. You know, it's like a half-day system, so it maybe still leaves time for them to pursue camp. And, I mean, so, yeah, I definitely sympathize with that. That said, again, there are two points I'll make. One new, one I'll just repeat myself. The first is the language of the state forcing wealthy parents into educational circumstances that they don't want, I think, is a little strong here. I mean, one very simple solution for wealthy parents, if they are unhappy with the public school system, is they can take them out of the public school system and put their kids in private schools or, you know, school their children at home. It's not like the state monopoly on education applies universally, and everyone who is a U.S. citizen must send their children to public school. I'm willing to acknowledge there's a cost there. That saying, you know, expanding the school year is fine because the rich kids can just go to private schools. You know, that's not an easy argument to make. But it also seems to me, insofar as a cost there, it is a cost that already applies to the current school year as well. You know, the wealthy parents might have children who are not optimally served by the current school year. And again, the second thing I'd say is that even if I acknowledge, and I do acknowledge, that there is in some sense a net negative for human freedom here, I on the side of expanding summer vacation, I don't know how you'd weigh that against what seems to me like the net increase in human freedom that comes from expanding opportunity. You know, it's just there's no,
okay,
like,
well,
what's the mathematical equation there that you'd use?
I think that equating increased test scores with a net increase in human freedom is a little bit...
How would you describe it then? I mean, so these kids will have the opportunity to go to better schools and have a greater choice among careers and have a greater choice among where they will live and have a greater choice among how they will organize their lives.
I mean, if you think that higher scores on standardized tests necessarily imply all of those things...
Yeah, no, I do.
Sure.
I do think that's the case.
Okay. Well, I don't know that I think that's the case. I'm gonna stay agnostic on that point. I guess in many matters of education, this one included, I would say that probably the best approach would be to decide these kinds of things at the local level, so that in places where it makes sense for kids to have to catch up over the summer, that they be offered those resources, and in places where it doesn't make sense, you don't do that. And I think there are all sorts of factors that come into play here that impact things in different regions. I mean, certainly how hot it is during the summer, for example, probably matters. Obviously, socioeconomic status matters, and so does the amount that you have to spend on teachers and the culture of teachers in the place that you're at. I mean, summer vacation is a big perk for a lot of teachers. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it would affect the incentive to become a teacher if you got rid of it and structured it differently.
Yeah, and just to say, I do the argument from cost is I think a very good objection. I mean, it would be really, really costly to keep school open all year long.
Right, and so I think we've been sidelining that. I mean, maybe it would be the most cost-effective. Maybe it wouldn't be.
I just want to say, on that point, you know, I don't know how to weigh these things perfectly, but it is also true that there is a lot of underutilized capacity that attends to not keeping schools open all year long, both in terms of, so there are two things here. One is you have a bunch of buildings that are not being used for their intended uses. And then, you know, insofar as there might be additional underutilized capacity, it is parents who now have their kids home for 3 months and have to reorganize their working lives, their professional lives, around the fact that schools are no longer in operation. And again, you know, that's
one way to put it. Another way to put it is that they get to spend quality time with their kids that they don't get to spend.
Again,
it all depends on what kind of people you're talking about.
Yes, if you're talking about wealthy people, they will certainly have a far easier time dealing with the facts that their kids are home for the summer. And if you're talking about less wealthy people, I think you'd agree on the whole, they will have a less easy time dealing with the fact that they're...
I don't think that's a very good generalization. I mean, I think that there are wealthy people in Manhattan who work two jobs and would have and would be much more inconvenienced by having their kids home over the summer than
why couldn't
say,
they ship their kids
you know,
to camp?
They could, but you know, they have to deal with it in some way that say a family with one working parent and a homemaker living somewhere in the Midwest say would have a very easy time. I don't think that wealth maps on very well to.
Well,
dealing with that, and I certainly acknowledge that there are a lot of poor working parents that it would be an added burden for. I don't mean to exclude those people. I just don't think that it's like a direct line between wealth and ease.
I think, yeah, I mean, maybe direct would be putting it strongly, but I mean, it certainly seems. I mean, it does seem like intuitively the case that the amount of resources you have to spend on your child would improve the ease with which. You would be able to give your child thing, or you know, just deal easier with the fact that your child is home for an additional 3 months. But I'm sure there's empirical research on exactly this question.
Yeah, I mean, I think time is a different kind of resource. But I think actually, I think we both laid out our points here. We should move on. What's next?
So what is next? Talk radio, I guess. Is that right?
Talk radio.
Yeah. So you've written many, many things about. Is it Mark Levin?
Mark, I think Levin is how you say
okay.
it. Mark Levin.
And indeed got into a little bit of a brouhaha with him, right? He had some great thing, like he called you Connor Freezer's dork on his website or something. He's some utterly stupid. Anyway, I was kind of following that a little bit. I certainly, read a number of your posts on it, but give us a summary of what you think about talk radio and how this argument.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Orange County, California, which is a very very conservative place, and talk radio is big there. There was a period of time when Rush Limbaugh was at his sort of at his highest point. When was it? It must have been around like the Gingrich Revolution, I think. Although these are childhood memories, so I may be wrong. But they actually had rush rooms in different restaurants and like hotels around Orange County, where people would like go in at lunch and listen to him, in like a public setting together. And so I've been exposed to a lot of talk radio. My grandparents are talk radio listeners, and I think that this is why when I was home recently in California, I got into my mom's car to go on an errand and turned on the radio, and there was Mark Levin, whose show I'd never really heard before. And when I flipped on the dial, it happened that he was telling a female caller, he asked her, "Are you married, yes or no?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "I don't know why your husband doesn't put a gun to his head and pull the trigger," and sort of shouting.
Oh, geez.
And so it was very striking to me. You don't hear that kind of thing really on Rush Limbaugh or on John and Ken, who are the sort of drive time, most popular drive time hosts in L.A. You hear a lot of yelling and political stuff on their show, but nothing like that.
Right.
And so I posted just a transcript of that basically on the American scene and said, "Wow, this is, you know, awful." I didn't really understand it. And Mark Levin ended up writing a guest post on another blog criticizing David Frum and Rod Dreher, who were two bloggers that saw my post and posted about the same thing. And and then I sort of got into the comments section with Mark Levin when he sort of posed a challenge to me. Well, don't judge me from listening to 15 minutes of my show. You know, dig into the substance of what I am saying. And I've since done that in a number of posts, and I do not think the substance of what he is saying reflects very well on him in many cases.
And because a lot of it is ad hominem, or because he is not a smart
person? I think, I mean, you know, obviously I can't judge, I can't know whether he's a smart person or not, but I do think that he is.
Sorry,
I mean,
you know, the seriousness with which he
given the things that he's done in his career, I assume that he is a very intelligent person. And I would say that on his radio show, and I'm not talking about his books here, on his radio show, I do not think it is a very high level of discussion. I think there's a lot of ad hominem. I think that he is constantly vilifying his opponents in a way that leads him to just absurd analytical points. And by doing this, I think he is really misleading his audience about the nature of reality. I mean, when he talks, for example, about how Barack Obama right now is motivated by a fervent desire for the economy to fail, that everything he's doing is a deliberate attempt to make the economy fail, well, that doesn't serve conservative listeners well to look at Obama's policies through this lens. I think there are a lot of good reasons to disagree with Obama's economic policies right now. That isn't one of them. And it's the kind of thing where if you say it to someone outside of the talk radio echo chamber, they look at you like you're a nut. So I guess I have two objections to Mark Levin's show. And one are these bits of analysis that just strike me as absurd, and the other is the tone of the show, which is just a lot of yelling and ugliness. And, you know, David Frum has made the point that if an independent voter were to turn on a show and listen to it, they would hear all the yelling and ugliness, and they would think, wow, whichever side this guy's on must be wrong. And I think there's some truth to that, but actually I have a different concern about the tone. And it is just that kind of tone prevents useful arguments from happening, and I think useful arguments are a good thing. I think that they help people to clarify what they're thinking, help them to articulate their own opinions. And, you know, I used to cover immigration in California and interact with a lot of talk radio listeners, and I saw the way that the rhetoric on the shows affected the way that they argued in person. And I think, you know, countless times I saw people who had actually salient substantive points that you know, a fair-minded person might be persuaded by, and the way in which they made the point when they were talking to others made it so that no one would ever listen to them. And I think on the right now it's just verboten to criticize any of these guys. You see politicians falling over themselves to apologize anytime they dare to say something bad about Rush Limbaugh.
Rush in particular.
And I think that it's absurd. I mean, I think when you think someone is, you know, making a mistake in their rhetoric or in the substance of what they're saying, you criticize them. That's what you do, especially if you're, a writer, especially if what you do is weigh in on these kinds of things. And you know, if you're at all on the right, if you at all consider yourself a libertarian or a conservative, you always hear, "Well, why are you attacking the guys that are on the same team?" And I just think it's a mistaken way to look at it. I think that if someone on your team, however useful that location is, if they make a mistake, you're doing a service to your team by correcting them and therefore correcting the mistake.
So this isn't a subject about which I've thought a great deal, but I wonder if I could recharacterize your argument like this. So part of the problem with these guys is they're just wrong on a lot of stuff. It's just that they have a factual problem. It is simply not the case that Barack Obama is motivated by a desire to destroy the United States, and so on. And part of the problem is that the way in which they present their arguments is practically, as a practical matter, not convincing. Because the rhetoric is so over the top.
And I think mistakes in style often lead to mistakes in substance. if you have an argument against something that I say and I respond by attacking you personally, well, that is a stylistic problem, right? But it's also a substantive problem, because if all I do is call you names anytime you criticize me, I don't take the time to formulate actual arguments. And if you go and look at the way that Mark Levin has responded to all of this criticism, it's basically by calling me Connor Friedersdorf on his website.
I for one was convinced
right,
by that argument.
Well, I think there were two or three others who might have been convinced by the same thing, and I knew them in third grade when I heard Connor Friedersdorf for the first time. Friedersdorf was, I thought, a more creative takeoff on my last name.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. Friedersdorf, Friedersdorf, they sound kind of the same. I always kind of like that one.
I wonder, I think basically there's very little there that there's nothing in what you said that I disagree with. When I lived in Seattle, I listened to Rush a fair amount and listened to Michael Savage a fair amount. And thought they were very entertaining people. I listened to Rush basically when I would drive to work, and I would listen to the Michael Savage show when I would drive back from work. I thought they were very entertaining. And as a good liberal, I also thought the substance of what they said was often preposterous and unconvincing, and the way in which they presented it was also offensive and unproductive. That said, I suppose there are a couple questions here. One is, what's the problem with holding a belief passionately, such that you would be willing to go to the mat for it and defend it in a scrappy way? It does seem to me while that offends a sensibility. Mm-hmm. When I think about, what might be like big problems for American democracy or whatever, a less kind of sort of grand sounding version of that, I don't know that that too many passionately held beliefs is a big problem. It seems to me that one problem is a lot of apathy and people that don't hold any beliefs at all, or who have interests that are not adequately expressed in the political system. So, for example, the classic example here is the interests of the average American consumer versus the interests of any special interest producer. The interests of the consumer in the American political system, and public choice economics has wonderful explanations for why this is the case, never win, because they are not passionately expressed. And so while I do find a lot of it offensive, I do kind of wonder about saying the tone of American politics should be a less passionate one. I think that argument becomes to some extent more complicated. I also think, if you look at the kind of standard lefty criticism of the mainstream media, and it's not necessarily a criticism that I buy, but I think there's something to it. It seems to me that the standard lefty criticism is, a lot of it is there's a club mentality to media that columnists for the Washington Post can't say what they really think about George Bush or something like that because they have all these friends and they want the think tank appointments. There's the whole kind of network of it to some extent. Brings down the amount of passion and the genuine commitments that would otherwise exist. I don't actually have a question at the end of this. What do you think about that?
Well, a couple things. I think you'll often hear Mark Levin, for example, talk about how the reason that he is angry on a show, the reason that he yells at callers, is because he is so passionate about his beliefs. Because he cares so much about the terrible things that are happening to America that he wants to fight and do battle with the liberals to change things.
And you just think even by his own standard he's unproductive.
Well, I do think by his own standard he's unproductive, but I also think that for example, telling this woman to that her husband ought to put a gun to his head. You know, in what way is that fighting liberals?
There's no political commitment involved there. Yeah, no, I agree with that.
There's some sense in which a lot of the ugliness doesn't actually it isn't a political argument. And I should make clear, I have no problem with passionate rhetoric. I have no problem with forceful arguments. Look at someone like Christopher Hitchens, right? It's very hard to accuse him of being passionless in his arguments. But he's also substantive in his arguments. So I'm not going to say that he never makes a logical fallacy or something like that. But I think generally he is substantive, and he is making the soundest arguments that he knows how to make. I think on talk radio, on the other hand, I think it's a mistake to imagine that they're engaged in a political project and that they're just so passionate about it. In fact, I think that a lot of the anger is shtick, and I think that that they do it to draw ratings, and they acknowledge this. I'm not assuming this. A lot of talk radio defenders will say, well, look at the numbers they get. You know, if you talked like a host on NPR, you can't get those kind of numbers. And I think there's truth to that. And I think that Rush is really entertaining. He has a big audience. Mark Levin has a big audience. And if you're evaluating them on the basis of the audience they can attract and, the market share that they can command, well, you know, there aren't grounds for criticism there. But I think that they do this constant shift where one minute they're a conservative thought leader and the next minute they're just an entertainer, depending on the criticism you're levying against them. And I think if they're an entertainer, if that's what they are, then fine. But if they want to be taken seriously in the world of ideas, then they deserve criticism. And that's the realm in which I am criticizing them. And finally, I would say, I think there isn't as much evidence as people think that they help the conservative cause in any way. I mean, take someone like Rush Limbaugh and think of how influential he is, right? Well, we just had a Republican primary where John McCain, perhaps the candidate that Rush Limbaugh would have won, won the nomination. And is it possible for that to happen, for him to win a Republican primary and for Rush Limbaugh to be so influential among the American electorate when he can't even influence the GOP primary in the last election?
It is also true that you can still be the most influential person in the party. Not that I necessarily think Rush Limbaugh is, and still not command
absolutely.
The majority
That's
of the party
true.
Support.
So I would just want to emphasize that I am not against forceful arguments. I'm not against arguing with passion. I think a lot of the arguments I've written against talk radio have been written forcefully and with passion. I just think that it's a mistake to think of political discourse using war metaphors. I think it's absurd to say we're going to go to war with the liberals, because like what does that mean exactly? How does a war metaphor map onto effective political discourse? In a war, you're effective if you kill the other side. In political discourse, you're effective if you persuade the other side. All of these shows sooner or later use this war metaphor, and I think that fundamental misunderstanding is part of the problem.
I don't disagree with that, so we can move on. We've been going for just a little bit over an hour. I don't know if you want to talk very briefly about your ideas blog. Talk very briefly about the Aspen Ideas Festival that the Atlantic
plays a big role in the Aspen Ideas Festival. It's going on now in Aspen. A lot of the writers and editors are out there thinking big thoughts, and I am not including us. We're both back in D.C., and I'm writing this ideas blog, and an ideas blog, it's a fun thing to do because it gives you a lot of latitude to sort of talk about a lot of different things. I've tried to not get too bogged down in, what belongs on an idea blog, what doesn't. Just tried to air a lot of different ideas from all sorts of realms. And I think, one of the ideas that that I've had that I would like to see put into practice, for example, is a solution to traffic in Los Angeles, where where I grew up, the LA metro area, and to just give a quick taste of this idea. It's basically that we're at a point now where we have GPS technology. We have these smartphones that everyone's carrying around.
Mm-hmm.
We have software developers who are able to produce really sophisticated apps. Why couldn't you have a system where if you're sitting in your apartment in Brentwood near UCLA and you wanted to go out to the beach and you don't have a car, well, you could put in the address that you're at and the address that you want to go to and press send, and it would go into a little network. And there would be a bunch of people in cars, and they would also be on this network, and up it would come on their screen, you know, the route, you know, they would have put in when they left home, right? Here's where I am. Here's where I'm going. And this would match people mm-hmm. who had cars with people who needed rides. And, you know, so a person in the car would be the first to see your request, and they would sort of punch a little button on their iPhone, and they would confirm that, yes, I will pick this person up. And then they would swing by and get you, and you'd be in their car, and you would swipe a little card on their dashboard, and maybe you would pay them, you know, some amount. I don't know.
Everyone would be a cab driver is basically the... I mean, it is... I don't know too much about how the taxi cab industry works in Los Angeles. I do think in most urban areas, the taxi cab industry is the most heavily regulated industry at all, where you both have a de facto price ceiling and a de facto price floor and a finite supply of... I mean, it's just crazy in all sorts of respects.
I would want to
so
do
you would
with
presumably
that.
Want to
and,
do away with that.
And, you know, there are some obvious obstacles that come up. I think technology really does solve the coordinating obstacles, I would argue. There is the sort of safety slash cultural obstacle. Are people going to be willing to get in the cars of strangers? And I think there's reason to believe that maybe that culture could develop. I think couch surfing is a pretty good example of this, where there's this huge community of people in various countries that actually let people stay in their homes overnight. Which is a much bigger barrier to than, you know, getting in someone's car. And if you think about how you would do it, I think one way would be to verify people, you know, so that you could have your credit card, your driver's license, even your thumbprint on file with the system, the you know, Cars in Los Angeles system, right? And as a rider, you could choose only to ride with verified drivers, and maybe that would be a little bit more expensive. And as a driver, you could choose to only pick up verified passengers, and maybe you would get a little bit less for driving them around. And you would just sort of adjust the rates so that the market worked out.
Is it also possible? I guess kind of thinking through the economics. I mean, is it also possible this would just increase the demand for cars because you are providing an additional source of revenue for everyone that owns a car?
Again,
which, and you know, if you imagine that it increases the demand for cars, then presumably it would.
I don't think it would decrease
it would make congestion worse.
Increase the demand for cars. I mean, I think it would lead. You would only be making money if people were using the service and therefore carpooling. And I think that, you know, you'd obviously have to set the prices right, and that might be the trickiest part of the whole equation. But obviously this is an idea that I've thought of recently, and so it may be that there are huge flaws that I'm not seeing. I don't think that that's one of them, but I am definitely persuadable that it is.
And what is there an advantage to this over just, say, taxing congestion, which would presumably also at the margin encourage people to carpool and decrease the – because it seems to me that while your idea is interesting, it doesn't, you know – I guess it provides a financial incentive to carpool. On the other side of the equation, it seems like it also provides a financial incentive to own a car. The problem of congestion is basically one where individual drivers don't internalize the social cost.
Well, I mean,
the car is
a pretty big expense when you take into account gas and insurance and upkeep, and also the cost of finding a place to park, which even though LA is better than a lot of big cities, it's still there are neighborhoods in LA where it's really tough to find a parking spot. I think those costs are high enough that I think there are a lot of people who would love to be able to live in LA without a car if they could get reliable transportation. And I think actually another thing that would happen, another good point about this plan, is that once it were implemented, you'd be generating a ton of data about where people need to travel and when. And I think that you would have mm-hmm. businesses spring up, right, where there would be like a shuttle van running from one place to another between certain hours that would accommodate a bunch of people who would all get in and swipe their little cards, and mm-hmm. you know, they would collect all those fares. I think that it would end up being a much more efficient system than, you know, the MTA deciding on bus routes and having them stuck for mm-hmm. decades, the same bus routes. I think the data generation would be another good point. But did you have any other thoughts in general about ideas, blogs?
No, I mean, I saw we don't necessarily need to spend too long on this. I saw you link to an old John Chait piece that I find very appealing. I think you linked to it this morning. Basically, and maybe, you know, this can be our last thing. Basically, the Chait piece is a kind of argument against new ideas. And my sense of Chait's argument basically is he wants to say the great problem we have is not, as everyone says after every election, a shortage of ideas on one side or the other, but a shortage of priorities. That is, you know, there are just a huge number of think tanks generating new ideas, generating new policy prescriptions. But what we're really bad at is figuring out which of those pre-existing ideas are good, and then figuring out how to pursue those ideas in a practical way. And I think, you know, I think Chait's argument basically is that we should spend more time prioritizing politics over ideas, that we should spend more time figuring out how to make the ideas we have, you know, bear fruit in the real world rather than coming up with a new set of useless ideas. And I guess that is very contrary to the spirit of Aspen.
Well, I don't actually think it is. I think that Chait makes a good point inside the realm of
because
electoral
politics.
Because
it is also a new idea.
I mean, I think that Chait's critique was at its strongest when he was basically saying that, you know, ideas are sort of talked about, but sort of as a buzzword. I mean, you know, the Republicans are always saying, oh, we have the best ideas. The Democrats are always saying, oh, we need new ideas. That's how it was then. Now it's kind of the reverse, where the Republicans are saying, oh, we need ideas. The Democrats are saying, oh, we have all the good ideas. But if you think about something like the Aspen Ideas Festival or the current issue of The Atlantic, the ideas issue, I would argue that both things are actually exercises in prioritizing ideas. I mean, you have mm-hmm. very carefully selected articles that are addressing certain topics. It's no accident that climate change is one of the pieces mm-hmm. in the Atlantic's issue. They had Graham Wood write about that because the editors decided this is one of the ideas that should be prioritized. It's just one of the topics mm-hmm. that should be prioritized. So I think that actually the Aspen Ideas Festival and the Atlantic issue and hopefully a curated blog like mine sort of help to right. pull certain ideas and draw greater attention mm-hmm. to them, and in that sense, they are prioritizing.
The Aspen Priorities Festival,
yes.
or
yes,
yeah, the ideas, the priorities blog, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you could almost change the name to the Aspen Priorities Festival, and not much else would have to change, I don't think.
Right, except less people would want to go.
Well, yes,
fewer people would want to go. All right. Well. Shall we call it a day?
Yes, I think so. It's been fun, and I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks, Connor.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.